Well, as you see with my title, I'm saying that moving from expected to unexpected comparisons, and I'm going to talk about the realm I'm calling the expected comparisons first, which is more or less what I've done to this point in my career in terms of comparative urbanism. And then this paper is really kind of a thought experiment and a mode of speculation about a project that I'm beginning. I just moved. I was at the University of Kansas for 16 years and just moved to Trinity College last fall, where I'm in a unit that's quite similar to Cities at Manchester in some ways, this interdisciplinary unit called the Center for Urban and Global Studies, which has, as a part of its mission, a lot of the same kinds of conceptual, applied, open-door sort of realm that was described yesterday in terms of what Cities at Manchester is attempting to be about. And so as a part of that, I've been engaged with learning about Hartford, Connecticut, and so I would not in any way, shape, or form be able to say that I'm an expert on Hartford, though I grew up fairly nearby. This is my way of looking at the unexpected comparison of saying, as someone who's focused his career on cities in Africa, what do those cities have to say to cities in the United States? So here are the things that I'm calling expected comparison. I've worked on three major projects of my own dealing with comparative urbanism, all three within Sub-Saharan Africa. The first one, which is a book that came out about 10 years ago called Verandas of Power, I was looking at Nairobi, Lusaka, Zanzibar, and Lilongwe, and particularly looking at it from the lens of history. I'm a historical geographer. Those people do exist, by the way, Leif. It's sort of historical and geographical, weird people that we are. The second project has a lot of resonance with the previous speaker's talk with Martina, dealing with the United Nations. I was focused on the Sustainable Cities Program and found that a particular focus there was on solid waste management. Although I focused on the cities there in Dar es Salaam, Zanzibar, and Lusaka, and Dar was the pilot project for that program in the world, it did operate in some 45 cities. And so it enabled me to look at cities around the world and see the ways in which that program played out, whether it was in Katowice in Poland or Chennai in India or Concepcion in Chile. And it seemed, at least in the African context, that the way to analyze those comparisons was to come up with a set of themes. And the themes that resonated with me in those contexts were how neoliberalism and the good governance lingo that's associated with it, the discourse around sustainability, and what I call the politics of cultural difference, intersect with this program and in a sense debilitated it, but also just transformed what its purposes were, and so I moved in a sense away from a very small island, literally, for where I did my dissertation to broaden the comparative lens a bit. And in each of these cases, the first two projects, I found, as I say in the paper, that I was surprised at people who would kind of email me out of the blue that they'd read this book, whereas I came to both projects out of African Studies. I was director of the African Studies Center at Kansas and I have a master's in area studies. So I was looking at an audience saying, well, geographers, you know, they study like climate change and things that they don't pay attention to African cities. So I'll just write for the audience that I know, which would be African Studies. And I was surprised to see there's much more resonance around the world of urban studies than I guess I expected. Which led me to my third project, which is the book African Cities that came out last year. And in this case, I was speaking to the relationality between cities across the continent, experimenting with the themes that might play out. What do we see when we look at the continent as a whole? Are there themes that resonate that can be applied across the continent and then might be used as a way of speaking back to urban studies in what whatever term we need now besides global north and global south. The themes that I came up with in there, post-colonialism, informality, governance, violence, and cosmopolitanism. I should say, and those of you who may have seen this will know, it comes out of a very long conversation with one of my supervisors for my master's and my PhD looking at the idea of Los Angeles as a post-metropolis. So my question in the first chapter in the book is, what if the post-metropolis is Lusaka? It doesn't have to be Lusaka. It could be any place. It changes the way you look at cities in the world when you're not basing everything around Los Angeles. I think there are benefits to making these kinds of regionally based comparisons. And I don't by any means suggest that comparative urbanism needs to abandon that sort of regional lens, and especially when we're thinking of it in terms of single human beings or even two or three human beings and their levels of expertise and understanding, the complexity and diversity that exist even within one region, even as we saw with Colin, within one city, it behooves us to keep with some range of expertise rather than suddenly jetting off and saying, I know something about cities in Australia. So there is a balance of that. But I think at the same time, one of the feelings that I've had is that there's a danger of fitting into the kinds of prescribed divisions of global urbanism that we're challenging here and that we're talking to over the course of this conference about global north and global south, third world, first world, etc. And it, in spite of using the strength of working with expertise in a particular region of the world or particular culture area, it still then necessarily almost brings us to a relatively small range of cities. And that's not too far, and I'm critiquing myself in this, that's not too far from what a lot of scholars of Southern urbanism critique about the global north. If you're going to say that, you know, Los Angeles or New York or Chicago is the model for global urbanism, is it different if you say, well, Nairobi is the model of global urbanism, or cities like Nairobi and Dar es Salaam are the way in which cities around the world are becoming? I don't think that's taking us. It just makes something different. It doesn't take us in a necessarily enlightening direction. And that brings the third question, which I'm not really sure about, is those of us who focused on cities in what, as my little quote marks there say, the global south, does that change urban disciplines? I think there are some examples we find of people who are, I guess, liberated from the notion that they have to speak to the entire world from Chicago by seeing the critiques that come out of cities in South America, or cities in Asia, or cities in Africa. But then how does that change the nature of the enterprise? Where do we find a sort of common ground, if there is any need for it? So the rest of this talk, I want to look at what happens if we turn things around to see what are the unexpected comparisons, as I put it. And some of this comes from Raywin Connell and others with the notion of bringing Southern theory into the realm of northern cities, or as Ananya Roy has talked about, you know, making the cities of the global south the place that generates the theory that tells us about cities. But what I want to try to do is to see if we can move from taking the single city and saying this is the model or this is the place to build from, to think this all through together in terms of folks whose careers have been in the Netherlands or Brazil, together with people who've worked in China or Kenya. All the things that my discipline does in cities, how do we come up with a way of talking together about these issues? And so in this thought experiment, I'm taking my own experiences from Eastern Africa and looking back at Hartford. Do we learn anything new from this? And I think there are some possibilities. Particularly if we're looking at a city like Hartford, and I'll give you some examples about Hartford in a minute, which is one of America's most divided cities. And so if we're looking at issues of poverty and inequality and good or bad governance, seeing as both the previous mayor and the previous governor of the state of Connecticut and mayor of Hartford are in jail, it's not sub-Saharan African urbanisms that have any sort of control over the nature of governance being a criminal enterprise. So if African cities are, as so many observers will put them in, so poor and so divided, why aren't they the cities that we study? If we want to understand poverty and inequality, why do we look to the models of other places for that? I think that there are some useful ideas that come from this approach. First, I want to give you some sense of Hartford. I know there's some people who will have some familiarity with it, but it surprises a lot of people to see that this is a city with a relatively high Gini coefficient. There's actually a metropolitan statistical area closer to New York City that ranks the highest in the United States. It's comparable on the Gini coefficient of income inequality to Nairobi. At the same time, Connecticut is the richest state in the United States in income per capita. And although my colleagues and I at Trinity are still in kind of disbelieving mode, if you look at the Brookings Institution's study of comparative metropolitan areas in the world, there's a chart on gross domestic product per capita, and ranked up there above Dubai and Abu Dhabi and Oslo and San Jose, the first ranked city is actually Hartford, Connecticut. So it's apparently the richest city in the world. At the same time, that it is, other studies will show, the city itself, when you subtract all of the super rich suburbs, one of America's poorest cities. And a model that you can look at for that is to see that somewhere between 40 and 50% of the children live in households without health insurance, and Hartford's claim to fame is it is America's insurance city. It's the capital of the insurance industry in the United States. And the latest indicators are 43% of children live below the poverty line. So this looks a lot like cities I've studied, and especially because the neighborhood that I'm working in now is extremely violent. And has a long history of violent crime over the last 30 years. It's been declining slightly over the last 5 to 10 years, but I happened to arrive at a moment of the most extreme violent incidences that the neighborhood had seen in the last 10 years. The names of them are Barry Square and Frog Hollow. They lie on either side of the campus, and just to give you some analyzed some data for this, a little bit less than 25,000 people, and you had about 300 violent crimes. So it's pretty high. Almost 50 murders that took place in a, you know, these are, you can walk through both of these neighborhoods. They're pretty small. And so this is again something that resonates with my experiences in Africa. It seems to me like this makes sense. We have extreme income inequalities in both of these neighborhoods, and this magnified beyond belief when you take it into the wealthy suburbs outside of it. Incredible diversity within Hartford City, and the surrounding suburbs, and you'll see in a minute on one of those little dot map things, the surrounding suburbs are overwhelmingly 90-95% white. The city itself is 55% Puerto Rican, and a significant number of immigrants coming over the last 10 to 15 years from fairly unexpected places like Peru and Ghana that have made it overwhelmingly a minority-majority city. And this just gives you a picture of it from the larger scale. The city proper is the area of obvious great density, and blue here is African American, and orange is Latino or Latina. So it's basically a black north, Hispanic south, and white everywhere else. Just to give you some sense of this as well, it's a city that has experienced tremendous and continues to experience a tremendous fallout from the financial crisis. Not to put too fine a point on it, but it's also very closely connected in with Wall Street. The reason why it ends up on the top of the charts, besides the insurance wealth, is in terms of venture capital and investment income. But in the city itself, you have this desperate poverty. And with the crisis, supposedly we're told that the recession ended in the United States somewhere in 2009. It doesn't look to have done so in terms of foreclosures in Hartford. My other example, to put sort of empirical teeth on this, is the other big controversy right now has to do with public transport and looking at a program that has been approved and it's had all of its environmental protection agency approvals and funding has been mechanized for it to connect up Hartford with a satellite city. It's about 10 miles away, New Britain. Equally poor, equally deindustrialized, building through a semi-abandoned railway line to make a busway, and then connecting out to a variety of other satellite cities. And this is billions of dollars that are being spent on this to connect up two poor inner cities across a 10-mile stretch. So I look at these issues and I say, you're going to have a substantial amount of short-term employment, lucrative contracts that went into this, and a small-scale long-term controversy. Okay. All of these things seem to me to say, in spite of what I thought when I moved to Connecticut, that I was coming and bringing a useless toolkit to this Center for Urban and Global Studies, that actually the things that I've spent 25 years learning about have a lot of resonance. Do they compare one to one? I don't know. And as I said, I'm just in the beginning of this process of thinking about it. But can the city of Hartford learn lessons that come from Africa? The first place that I look to this is in terms of UN Habitat and the work that's been done there over the last 10 years. And these are just some example texts. The State of the African Cities book, the two of them that have come out, and the State of the World Cities. I use those three because they come through the particular lens, not just of UN Habitat, but of the period of executorship of UN Habitat with Anna Tibaijuka, whose work as an economist is well known in Tanzania. She's now the Minister of Lands and Human Settlements in the Government of the United Republic of Tanzania, Tanzania having been the place I've spent most of my career. The problems with this sort of habitat approach that I see, there's a lot of good analysis to give us a sense in a place like Hartford of what are the divides that exist. They list out five different divides. And in my paper, I talk about economic divides and spatial divides that I think Habitat does a pretty good job of analyzing and interpreting that apply pretty well to cities in the United States. But then when it comes to where the rubber hits the road in terms of policy, it's a pretty bland and depoliticized kind of development speak that takes over. And that put into the experience of watching Dr. Tibaijuka as she returned to Tanzania and proceeded to vigorously enforce the 1955 town and country planning law still left over from colonialism and plow down neighborhood after neighborhood of the informal settlements of Dar es Salaam. Didn't seem to me like this was a practice of an inclusive city, so I kind of have dangerous thoughts of how this would be then replicated in a city in the United States. So instead, I want to look at alternatives, and I don't have a lot of time, so I don't want to go into great detail about this. But in the particular paper, I talk about Edgar Peterson, and he argues in the paper recently that the need for us to produce a more patient, in-depth, nuanced account of the mobile, diverse, and complex socialities that form and reform at the intersection of multiple identity spaces, networks, and imaginary registers. Like a lot of Edgar's work, it's, you know, it's a mouthful to get through that. But I think to my mind, that seems as something that clearly would be necessary to a study in a place like Hartford. And I don't see coming out of literature that has been done on the city of Hartford in particular. I'm not saying that I'm not an urbanist in the American context, so I don't know that there hasn't been literature that's done that kind of thing in cities in the United States. But where I've seen it in Africa, it looks to me as something that would be quite appropriate to take into the context of Hartford. And then I have two sort of pragmatic and practical examples, given what I was talking about, that we see in Cape Town, and I'm not going to say anything more detailed about this with Vanessa Watson in the room, but the Cape Town's program of violence prevention through urban upgrading. Dar es Salaam has also had a very substantial investment prior to Hartford in bus rapid transit. And are these things places to go to look at Hartford? And I say the last thing I would ever want is to take those examples and call them successes and then cut them whole hog out of the place where they belong and plunk them down on top of a city in central Connecticut. But I still believe those are areas and those are examples that can potentially inform the processes that are taking place in Hartford. I have a bunch of different pictures of these. This is the chart from the Violence Prevention Project. Literally, this is happening now in Hartford, where there's a program to use landscape architecture to reduce crime. And I have, in fact, said so to the mayor of Hartford. You should look at what happened to this program in Cape Town. Whether he listens to me or not, I have no idea. And I think every talk should have a cartoon. So I've got my Masoud Kipanya cartoon from Mwananchi in Tanzania. And this divide that he's portraying in the cartoon in Dar es Salaam, which, by the way, has a Gini coefficient that is, 0.3. It's quite admirable, one of the least unequal of the world cities, technically. But even there, we can see this sort of divide being picked up on. And this looks a lot like Hartford to me. Not to mention that the bus line takes the same shape and it's a little bit longer. But there clearly are ways of seeing comparability. To conclude, as I'm pretty much out of time, I think, I don't really see this as a thought experiment that led me to the ultimate conclusion that everybody who studies American cities needs to study African cities and start there and make that the way they learn about cities in the U.S. Instead, what I come to are these four points. I think the lesson that can be learned from studying cities in Africa and brought to other cities is to look at the fluidity and flexibility, the non-linearity, the unpredictability, the surprising things that you see in cities in Africa, and see them in Frog Hollow, in Hartford, see them in a different lens, even in Manchester. Rather than saying let's privilege cities of the South and abandon cities of the North, what can we do to not to say every city is the same, but to put them in a level analytical plane and begin to look at them in terms of comparability? And I think, as we've talked about already, one of the ways that we see that comparability emerging is in terms of policy circulations. And the two examples I'm giving in terms of preventing violence from through landscape architecture and the sort of busway projects, everyone seems to be aping Curitiba in that. And then lastly, that doing something like this by myself is impossible. And I think that we're seeing in urban studies more broadly how necessary broader teamwork is, and that comes out best, I think, when it's multi-regional, multicultural teams that are conscious of different disciplines and different agendas and can bring those together. Those aren't easy to pull off, but I think those kinds of research projects that many of us will be familiar with have been very successful. So,
thank you very much, Bill.